I think a deeper mix, and especially only, you might want to keep an eye on that and not get caught, you know, getting too cute and pushing his price down, and then, you know, realizing like, oh my gosh, I'm, you know, the last third of the auction and the options here are bad. Welcome to episode 178 of Flags Fly Forever, a baseball prospectus podcast. I'm your host, Mike Gianella, senior fantasy writer at Baseball Prospectus. And behind the glass, we have Gianmarco Ramos of the BP Stats team and the Hardball Times. And my co-host, who is here tonight, is Zach Steinhorn, fantasy editor of Baseball Prospectus. Zach, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. So in our last podcast, we were concerned that we might not have enough topics to talk about for this one, but I don't think that's going to be a problem this time.
Yeah, I figured, you know, Harper Machado haven't signed, but I figured we'd have, you know, enough going on. And actually, there's a lot of trades. But before I get into that, I just wanted to do the usual housekeeping reminders. You can listen, rate, and review us on iTunes and Stitcher and all those good places. Please do so if you can. Those ratings go a long way. Additionally, we're really excited for coverage on the site. The stats team just rolled out DRC Plus. We're just getting to the end of that week as we're recording it. It's a great metric. There have been some great stats articles, some great historical articles and fantasy articles. Please check that out. So without further ado, Zach, I'm going to throw it to you. You know, as I alluded to, it's Friday, December 7th, as we're recording this. Hopefully news doesn't break tonight. Friday's a good time to record for that reason. What do you want to talk about first? Is there a trade or a signing that jumps out to you?
So I guess the most fantasy impactful trade, even I guess just from a ranking standpoint, is we'll start with the trade of Paul Goldschmidt, and that's the Diamondbacks a few days ago trading Goldschmidt to the Cardinals for a package of players headlined by Luke Weaver. I guess he's the one guy going to Arizona that we kind of have a basic familiarity with as mixed league owners. But we all know the story with Goldschmidt. He got off to a well-publicized, brutal start to the season last year. He headed into June batting .209 with 7 homers and only 19 RBIs. But he was typical Goldie pretty much after that. I would say in about right around the time of late May to early June, he really picked it up, and he finished the year with a .290 average, 33 homers, 83 RBIs, and 95 runs scored. So the one major missing component to his game was the stolen bases. He stole only 7 bases. This after he stole 32 in 2016. He stole 18 in 2017 and just 7 last season. So the steals have been in steady decline. That's been the main reason probably why Goldschmidt is now more of a second round player in most mock drafts that I've seen. But how are you valuing Goldschmidt in fantasy right now? And do you think that the trade to the Cardinals helps him, hurts him, or do you think it doesn't really make much of a difference?
I think it might help a little bit with runs and runs batted in, because it looked like at most Arizona was not going to retool or try to commit to this year. You know, those numbers dropped last year, you know, and Zach, you point out why, you know, Goldie for like a 4 or 6 week period, like pretty much disappeared before he came back. But otherwise, he's the same player to me. I agree with you. The average isn't quite elite. You know, he's in the .290s, which is really good, but he's not hitting like .310 or .320. Power's there. Steals are really deliberate. Last year, at the beginning of the year, you know, he talked to management in Arizona, and they asked him, and you know, not to run as much, to cut back, to, you know, keep him healthy, keep him productive. I would imagine it'll be the same deal with the Cardinals. He might steal 10 to 15, maybe he bounces up a little bit. I just don't think you're going to see 20 or 30 steals. That puts him in the second round for me. Now, one thing I'll kind of point out, you know, it's interesting. I've been doing some like pre-prep for 2019. Corner's a little bit weaker, and first base in particular is a little bit weaker than it's been in the past. So I'm okay with taking Goldie in a 15 teamer late in the first round if you feel you want to stretch. And it's just something to keep in mind. Like in 12 team leagues, I don't think it matters so much. I think a deeper mix, and especially only, you might want to keep an eye on that and not get caught, you know, getting too cute and pushing his price down, and then, you know, realizing like, oh my gosh, I'm, you know, the last third of the auction and the options here are bad.
Yeah, I was able to actually get him at number 21 in a recent mock draft. So I don't really think that that price is going to hold true for very long. I think he'll kind of move up more towards that back end of the top 15 price. But personally, you know, I really wouldn't have a problem taking him even top 10, because I think, you know, even if the steals remain at sort of that 7 to 10 level, you know, he has such a high floor and high ceiling in the other four categories that I think it's just he's just a very safe pick sort of in that late first round neighborhood. Now, one thing to keep in mind with the steals, actually, is that the Cardinals last season ranked 25th in the majors in stolen base opportunities, which is stolen bases plus caught stealing plus pickoff. So I don't know if that's really going to mean much, but the Cardinals weren't really a very active team on the base paths last season. So I'm not sure, you know, if he's ever going to return to being that five category stud. But, you know what, as a four category, very reliable player, I'd be fine with him as, you know, even late first round, but especially as my second player I take in a draft.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I'm fine with him late first round, or, you know, if I have, like, if it's a 15 teamer and I'm in the middle and I'm not, like, I'm on the wheel, I doubt he's going to be there in the second round, but I'd be elated to kind of get him there.
All right, so let's now just look at Luke Weaver for a minute or two. And Weaver, now last season, 30 games, 25 starts, 4.95 ERA, 1.50 WHIP. And this was after he was being drafted in mixed leagues last year as a fourth, fifth starter in deeper mixed leagues. So a very disappointing year for him after putting together a very impressive 60 and a third inning sample in 2017. So Weaver, he regressed in pretty much every area, but most notable was the walk to nine rate, which rose from 2.5 to 3.6. So in deeper mixed leagues, is he someone that you're interested in for this coming year, or do you see him more as an NL-only guy?
In deep mix, I'll take Weaver toward the back end of a draft or as a reserve pick. I wasn't a Weaver fan heading into last year, so he obviously did nothing to, you know, suddenly change my mind. You know, my problem with Weaver is I've always liked the fastball. It's a good pitch. You know, if you watch him, he doesn't really have a secondary pitch that wows you. He does throw four pitches, so that's not the issue. He doesn't have those pitches. He just doesn't have a pitch where I'm like, you know, okay. And the other thing with Weaver, too, is, you know, I still wonder if his long-term future is in the bullpen. You know, obviously, Arizona is going to use him as a starter. They grabbed him, you know, for that reason. Last 2 years, his issues were in the second half with endurance. So I'm okay with taking him as a spec play in deep mix. He's not somebody I'd rely on.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I wasn't a big fan of him either heading into the last season. I thought he was really overvalued based on what was a 60-inning sample. So I wasn't too interested in him last year. And this year, the one positive with him this year is that you know that he's going to be in the rotation if healthy. So he's not going to – the Diamondbacks are going to give him every opportunity to be a, say – 160-inning type pitcher, because I guess no one throws 200 innings anymore, but at least to make, you know, be 25 to 28 starts. So that's the one thing you could rely on, I think, maybe more from an NL-only league standpoint. But in general, he's not someone I'd be – I'm going to be really targeting in drafts this coming spring. So let's now go. I think that pretty much does it, right? You have anything else more to say about the Goldschmidt trade?
I mean, Carson Kelly, two catcher leagues, you know, he's somebody you want to, you know, obviously grab onto. I think he's going to get mostly at bats. He has a good defensive reputation. You know, the other side of that is as a rookie, I don't see him playing 120 games. So he's to me, he's more of an NL only or matchups guy.
Yeah, he hasn't really done much in the majors yet. So, yeah, NL only league, second catcher in NL only league, that's fine. All right, so now let's move on to the ever interesting Jerry DePoto, who it looks like he's going to be maybe make what 10 trades between now and next week, possibly. Let's start with the Robinson. Well, actually, we always call it the Robinson Cano trade, but I've been correctly pointed out that it's really more like the Edwin Diaz trade. So Edwin Diaz and Robinson Cano traded to the Mets for Jay Bruce, Anthony Swarzak, Gerson Bautista, and the real keys to the trade were the two prospects that the Mariners got from the Mets, and that was Justin Dunn and Jared Kelenic. So I might be in the minority here, but I like this trade for the Mets. You know, that you give up Kelenic and Dunn, who are both highly regarded prospects, but you know, with prospects, you never really know, you know, what's going to happen. Both are former first round picks, but there's also a belief that Dunn could be long term will be in the bullpen, and Kelenic is still very young. But let's start with Diaz for a second. You know, we all know what he did last year with the 57 saves and the microscopic ERA and WHIP. He finished the season as the top ranked reliever on the ESPN player radar, and he'll probably be the first reliever off the board in most fantasy drafts this year. It's obviously going to be hard to duplicate what he did last year, but any general concerns about Diaz for 2019, other than the fact that, you know, he'll inevitably get hurt just because he's on the Mets now?
No, I mean, if there's a concern, it's that, you know, he's unlikely, you know, any pitcher's unlikely to post an ERA under 2 and strike out over 15 per 9. But that's pretty much it. You're looking at an elite reliever. He might even get a win or two. He had no wins last year, which would boost his value a little bit. Yeah, you're looking, even in a worst case, you're probably looking at a top 3 reliever. He's an elite arm, and there's no reason not to draft him that way. Philosophy about closers, you know, aside.
Right. Relief pitcher performance so hard to predict from, you know, one year to the next, but I don't see any reason. I agree with you about Diaz. And the big key to me was the most impressive stat for me with Diaz, aside from all the strikeouts, was 17 walks and 73 and a third innings. So that's always nice to see for any young pitcher. And he'll only be 25, actually, on opening day 2019.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, I know with interleague play, you know, and trades, there's less of not seeing a pitcher. But still, he's young enough that there's some teams in the National League that have never seen Edwin Diaz pitch, or at least have only seen video. He's going to give hitters fits who have never seen him or never faced him before. So, barring injury, you know, LOL Mets, you know, besides that, I think he's in line for a big year.
Yeah, the combination of age and also just the elite control that he's displayed already is I think, is a, you know, very, bodes very well going forward. So let's now, as for Cano, you know, there's a lot of negativity surrounding him, you know, which is understandable. What role did the PEDs play? And, you know, I guess his success over the past few years, we'll never really know. But, you know, the bottom line is that he did perform very well after he came back from the suspension. He batted 317, 6 homers, 27 RBIs, and an 860 OPS in 41 games. So, you know, he's not going to be a draft day target for me, but I still think that he's, you know, a fine fallback option if you miss out on those elite second basemen. Where do you stand with Cano for next season?
Well, I do want to say, so PEDs, you know, in the testing era, most players taking PEDs are taking them to, you know, kind of stay on the field for endurance, you know, for health and healing or recuperation. I don't think we're talking about the PEDs of like a generation ago where, you know, Barry Bonds was ripped and looked superhuman. And, you know, was like Bugs Bunny hitting the ball out of the park. So, and we've kind of seen that with a lot of these players their first year back, like Starling Marte, D. Gordon. You know, you could rattle off most of these examples. They've been fine their first full season back off a PED suspension. Now, it's a little bit different for Cano because he is older and second base is a rough position in terms of, you know, hanging in there. You know, my thing about Cano, we've got very early ADP. He's going about 140 overall. I do feel that's a little high based on what he brings to the table at this point. Like, we know he doesn't run. He's going to hit some home runs, but we're not expecting 30. I'd say 20, maybe 25 is like a more realistic expectation. We know the average will probably be there, but I look at these ranks here, and there's some second basemen I think I'd rather take than Cano at about 140. I don't have anything against him, but like you, Zach, he's just not somebody I'm really gonna push for in most formats.
Yeah, he's not someone I'd be overly targeting, but at the same time, he's not someone I'd be really disappointed with if. You know, the top elite guys, the Altuves, and that elite class of second baseman. If I could just wait a few more rounds and take Cano, you know, I wouldn't be overly disappointed.
Yeah, so. I I'd probably go like 17 in NL only for him, and I just have a feeling somebody's gonna like push him closer to 20.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I guess in mixed he would be maybe, well, I don't know, maybe 13, 14 is reasonable, something like that. But yeah,
then somebody will go 10 or 11 on him in mix, and it's the same thing. Like if you want Cano, I think you're gonna have to like pull for him in like the 10th round.
Yeah. So all right. So now the one. Anything else about Cano before we move on to?
No, not really. I mean, I think that, you know, everybody knows who he is, and you know, it's just the age question, and I think he's going to be solid for another year or two before he hits that ugly decline. I mean, the only caveat is that for every Adrian Beltre who hangs in there and does it forever, there's a lot of players where the end comes quickly, no matter how good they were.
Yeah, I think for the next, I say 2 years, he'll still be, you know, a solid above average hitter for the Mets. But it's just those last 3 years of the contract that's going to get very dicey. So we'll see how it turns out with that. But so the one, before we wrap up this particular trade, the one other mixed league relevant player who's included in this trade is actually Jay Bruce. And Bruce is coming off what was a disastrous season for the Mets from both a performance and health standpoint. But, you know, at the same time, I wouldn't completely give up on him in fantasy. You know, he'll be entering his age 32 season, so it's not like he's very old. And, you know, the batting average won't be good. But from a counting stats perspective, you know, if healthy, he's someone who's been, you know, fairly consistent from year to year. So I'm thinking maybe a change of scenery, you know, might do him some good. And in a mixed league auction, I'm thinking about maybe mixed auction tout. You know, he could probably be had for $5 or less, and I'll be intrigued at that price. Is Bruce someone who you're, you know, open to drafting next season, or is he someone who you're going to just stay away from completely?
I'm open to drafting him. The problem I have with him in the only formats that I play in is he's going to go double digits in that kind of format. And even if it's 11 or 12, it's the kind of thing where if he's hurt again, he doesn't play much. I've thrown $11 or $12 down for a player who's going to miss most of the year. I like him the way you like him, Zach. I like him as a deep mix play. He's going to go just inside or just outside of the top 300 in mixed, which is in a 15 team is a back end pick. That's a great place to pick Bruce, you know, and that $5 or lower bid that you mentioned, because if he's on the field, if he hits 30 home runs, which he's done before, he's done that. You know, I was looking at his numbers before. What is it like? Three of the last 4 years or two of the last years, whatever it is, we know he can do it. And if he doesn't work out in that format, you cut him or you DL him and you pick somebody else up pretty quickly. So, yeah, that to me is the play for Bruce as well. Deep mixed. Only I'm a little wary just because, like I said, if you take Bruce and he doesn't work, you're stuck. You're wasting probably about $11 on a player who isn't going to play.
Right. The upside might not totally be there, but just considering the price that he's going to be available at this season, I don't remember any year in which he's going to be available at this low of a price. So that in itself is going to be at least mildly appealing to me as draft season approaches. So now, you know, Jerry DePoto wasn't done. And the other big trade that he made over the past few days was with the Phillies, sending Jean Segura, Juan Nicasio, and James Passos to Philadelphia for Carlos Santana and J.P. Crawford. So I guess we'll start with Segura because he's probably the most valuable. He's clearly the most valuable fantasy asset. And, you know, Segura is pretty much a known fantasy commodity at this point. You know, he'll hit for average. He'll steal 20-plus bases. He'll score plenty of runs, provided that he hits at or near the top of the lineup. But if anything, I think his fantasy stock goes up with the move. I mean, he's shown that he has some pop, and he hit 20 homers for Arizona a few years ago. And moving from Seattle to Philadelphia, I think, you know, helps things from a power perspective. So I think you know, he's definitely someone I'll be interested in. You know, in that kind of what would that be like? Maybe 6 to 10 range among shortstops this coming season. Will Segura be on your radar this year? He'll definitely be on mine.
Yeah, I've always been a fan of his, and part of the reason for that is, you know, outside of that ridiculous career he had in 2016, he's just somebody who has always produced. Like, even when he was with the Brewers and he wasn't hitting for power and the average wasn't there, 25 steals or more. And he doesn't quite run that much anymore, but if he's a guy you can get 15 home runs, 20 steals, close to a 300 batting average, all that plays. Now, you know, an on-base league, obviously, he's not as valuable because he walks about 5-6% of the time, but he's just a player I like having on my teams. And typically, some of that is the price he goes for. I know that I think it was Chris Towers of CBS on social media was talking about Segura, and he was talking about Xander Bogaerts, and it's kind of holding. Bogaerts is going in early ADP about 35 slots ahead of Segura. It's really early. We know these numbers can change, but I want Segura. Like Segura is the guy of those two I know I'm going to want on my team, whereas, you know, I'm sorry, it's only 32 slots. I overstayed a little bit, but yeah, I'm always a big fan of a player like John Segura, who people just don't seem to have any respect for. He's going around Corey Seager, and Seager, I think he'll be fine this year, but, you know, we know what happened to him health-wise. He doesn't steal. He's not really an elite average guy. I have a feeling Segura's going to be on a lot of my teams this year.
I cannot agree more. I mean, Segura, he's the kind of guy who I think he's, you know, he's still underrated a little bit. And, you know, like you mentioned, you know, people are going to be reaching for the Bogaerts and the Seagers, and Segura just very quietly, you know, puts together productive season after productive season. So I have a feeling that, you know, when I make my, you know, Tout Wars cheat sheet, I think Segura might just be the first guy listed, you know, for my shirt.
I'm glad we're not in any auctions or drafts against each other, because so far it sounds like we agree on almost everything.
Yeah, I haven't met anyone who agrees with as much stuff as I do for fantasy owner wise. So yeah, good thing we're not in the same Towers League, because I would say there's about maybe an 80% chance that he'll be my starting shortstop this year. So we'll see.
Okay.
there's three players that are fantasy relevant in this trade. So the second one would be Carlos Santana. And speaking of Tout Wars, Santana was a guy who he was my first baseman in Tout Wars this past season. And, you know, he's viewed as a fantasy bust for 2018 by a lot of people, but I don't really see it that way. And maybe I'm biased because I mostly play in OBP leagues, but, you know, 24 homers, 86 RBIs, 82 runs, you know, pretty solid production from a guy you could get in the mid to late rounds. You know, the trade to Seattle doesn't help things at all for him. You know, the park is much less hitter friendly. Maybe the home runs will go down to more like 20 or high teens. But I guess in a non-OBP league, you know, he's not someone I'll be overly interested in. But in an OBP league, you know, he's an okay fallback option. I'm not quite as high on him as I was last year, but, you know, I think he's still at least slightly undervalued in fantasy.
Yeah, and the thing about him, you kind of hit the nail on the head. He's solid in OBP leagues. If you take him, you just have to take somebody else to offset that batting average. You're still looking at probably about 25 home runs, you know, 80 runs batted in. It's not great, but it's solid. And the other thing to remember is 2017 was the year of the home run. There was a big spike. 2018, league-wide, home runs dropped back to 2016 levels. So by standing still, Santana actually got a little bit better in the power categories. And that, to me, is a thing to keep in mind. I think he's going to be a little bit underrated this year. People are going to look at him as a disappointment. They're going to forget about him in Seattle. You know, what's tough about this with Santana, and getting back to Bruce, we don't know if they're going to be in Seattle all year. We don't know if the Mariners are going to have success trading Santana or Bruce or Kyle Seager or D. Gordon. If all those players I met, and Mitch Haniger, if all those players I mentioned are in Seattle, as much as we're writing them off, their offense isn't going to be awful. This isn't a case of like the Marlins or a bottom feeder where you're like, oh my gosh, there's Carlos Santana and nobody else in the lineup. They still might have opportunities to score runs and drive in runs. I'm not saying they're going to be a great team, but from a fantasy perspective, don't overestimate the Seattle effect and be like, well, I don't want any of these players.
Yeah, I agree. They're not going to be as good as last year just because there's going to be a net loss from all these trades. But still, they'll be, you know, a pretty formidable lineup. I think if anyone that might get traded, it might be Santana because of the contract. But, you know, like you said, I don't know who's going to be willing to take on that contract, even though it's not – I think, what is it, a three-year – I think there's maybe two or three years left on the contract.
Yeah, there's 2 years left. The problem right now isn't the contract. The problem is that half of baseball is not playing for 2019.
Right.
So that's where you kind of get stuck. It's like you look at his market and you're like, well, who's going to take him? Like, what team that's, you know, contending or thinks they're contending is going to take him? Like, there's a need, but a team in the past that might have said, hey, you know what, we're an 80-win team or a 78-win team. We'll start taking some chances. There's one team out there like that right now, and that's the Mets. And everybody else is playing it safe.
Yeah, I could totally see that. So let's now, the final player that is worth discussing in this trade from a fantasy, single-season fantasy perspective is J.P. Crawford, who actually, I know you drafted him in NL Labor on the team that I managed. And he's a former top prospect, but, you know, he's yet to do much of anything at the big league level yet. But last year, it might be unfair to criticize him too much because he did get injured. But, you know, he's still young. He has, a lot of potential. He should open 2019 as Seattle's starting shortstop. Are you in an AL-only league? Is he someone who you'd be interested in?
I'll take him in AL-only. The only thing about Crawford, there's two things. One is that the Mariners have already kind of hinted that he might start in the minors, and we all know that's a service time thing. That's not a real reason to keep him down. But putting aside how I feel about that, that impacts his price. I can't, you know, in good conscience recommend him strongly if he's going to be down the minors, I think, until May. I think Jarrett Sider, you know, also VP, kind of calculated that date. Putting that aside, I still like Crawford. The only caveat with him is that he's more of a real life asset than a fantasy asset. You know, particularly, it's funny, you look at his, he's a good example of somebody, his WRC plus was 96. He does not fare well under the new BP metric. His DRC plus last year was 84. That's a big difference. That tells you that from a descriptive and predictive standpoint, you know, it's 138 plate appearances. It's just not numbers you want. He's fast, but he's not base running fast. So I wouldn't expect more than like 8 to 10 steals, and that might be generous. There's not really a lot of power there. So even in a best case, if Crawford hits like 260, you're probably looking at an empty 260. So I still like him as a player, but for him and AL only to be worth, like, I'd say more than like $7 or $8, he's really going to have to like go out and play a full season. So long-term, I think he's okay. He's only 24 years old. The Mariners are going to have some time with him. I still think he has a productive career, but for 2019, I'm probably out.
And I mean, the one positive you could say is that maybe if he's healthy the whole season, he'll just get the counting stats because he'll just get the at-bats. So he'll get enough counting stats to be of some use in AL-only leagues. But like you said, he's strictly an AL-only play for me.
I just in long-term defense of J.P. Crawford, I saw him in AAA, like that's an hour north of me. He's a heck of a player. Like he's a good player. Like he's talented. You know, his AAA numbers his last year there were skewed because he was playing hurt there too. He came back from an injury and he was slumping and horrible for 2 months. He was great after that slump. I think Matt Winkleman of Phillies Prospects kind of like outlined that at his website. But really, for fantasy, it's just it's a really tough sell, and I get that.
Yeah, if you don't put up home run numbers and if you don't put up stolen base numbers, it's really tough to really be at least a mixed league asset in fantasy. You have to do either one or the other.
Yeah, and then even for only, like, you know, is I know this sounds rough, but is Crawford going to produce at, like, you know, Yolmer Sanchez last year, 8 home runs, 14 steals, about a .240 average. Is Crawford going to do that? I honestly don't know, and I know that sounds rough, but that's kind of the standard in and only, where it's like, I'd love to get Yolmer at those numbers for like $4 or $5. Cause I'll probably be able to get him or like a couple players like him at that price. I don't want to pay the only premium of 10 for Crawford cause he's a prospect and at best like break even.
Yolmer Sanchez was, I think, dropped and picked up like about 10 times in my Towers League last year. So epitome of a replacement level player in our league.
Yeah, mix is a whole different thing with a guy like Yolmer, and only you want to hold on to somebody who's getting at bats.
All right, so now let's move on to up until this point is the biggest free agent signing so far, and it was a little bit surprising with Patrick Corbin getting 6 years and $140 million from the Washington Nationals. I was sort of expecting the Yankees to get him, and possibly with the Phillies being a candidate, but the Nationals are a little bit surprising here. They already have, you know, Scherzer, Strasburg. They have a very potent top three in that starting rotation. Now, Corbin, he's coming off a career-best season, 11-7, 3.15 ERA, 1.05 whip, 246 strikeouts and 200 innings. So, and he certainly picked the right time to put together that career season because it was a contract year. The real knock on him is that, and we've you must have probably read it in a lot of BP articles, is that he relies very heavily on the slider, which is arguably the best slider in baseball. But that lack of those secondary pitches, you know, a lot of people, some observers think that, you know, that's not going to bode well long term. For 2019, you know, and with the Nationals, how do you is Corbin a number two starter? Is he a number three? How do you rate him for fantasy this year?
Well, he's definitely a two, and you know, he might even be like a 1B in a 15 team mix where I'd have him like right on the cusp of a one. I mostly believe in Corbin. I mostly believe that, you know, the changes he made were legitimate. I do expect some regression. You know, what he did last year, it's not just for him, but nearly any pitcher isn't sustainable. You know, but if you look at his DRA, if you look at his interior numbers, he really was a dominant pitcher. I think the only thing I'd be concerned about, you know, we saw this with him on our labor team, Zach. He did look a little fatigued at the end of the year. He had not thrown 200 innings, you know, post Tommy John. Like, he had thrown them in 2013, but then he had built up. He did look tired, but one thing I'll say about the Nationals, and we've seen this with Steven Strasburg, they're really good with their non-Max Scherzer pitchers of not overworking them and giving them rest and skipping starts. So, you know, I think you pointed this out before when you were talking about Luke Weaver. Corbin might only throw 180, 190 innings if the Nats, you know, kind of like rest him and don't like, you know, push the gas pedal down. But they're going to be really good. I see like a 3-2, a 3-3. The strikeout should drop a little bit, but you're still probably be looking at close to 200 strikeouts. So top shelf, no, but you're probably – I still see Corbin as a top 15-20 pitcher.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think solid number two starting pitcher, but at the same time, you know, be careful not to overvalue him a little bit. And I think that the market might do that, you know, considering what he did last year and the contract he signed. So I think, you know, I'm open to drafting Corbin, but I have a feeling that I'm not going to end up with him on maybe none of my teams just because of that market factor.
Yeah, I mean, he's top 50 overall right now in ADP. And, you know, I looking at it, he's a little higher. He's probably about half a round to a round higher than I'd like to take him. You know, now the funny thing about this, and I know these early ADP conversations are hypothetical, if you're doing like a who would you rather with some of the pitchers like around him, you know, right behind him are James Paxton, Steven Strasburg, Jack Flaherty, and Jameson Taillon. There's a lot of arms in that group who are also young. I don't want to say uncertain, but arms that have maybe just done it for 1 year or have had injury concerns of their own. So I think when you rank Corbin, I say he's only like a top 20 pitcher. We do have to be careful to keep the context in mind and the fact that pitching is more uncertain than it's ever been. And, you know, when I do my actual rankings, I might push Corbin up, not because I love Corbin, but because the pitchers around him have their own level of uncertainty and risk as well.
Yeah, so I would say I would rate him as sort of a mid-level SP2. But, yeah, definitely, like you said, probably top 20 starter. Yeah, at the same time, I'm curious to see how the market values him in mocks and then in early drafts to begin 2019, because I have a feeling that he's going to be a little too pricey for my liking. All right. Anything else on Corbin? I think we're good.
No, I think that's it for yeah. Corbin. I'm going to be interested to see what the Diamondbacks do. I guess Weaver's his replacement, which that's a big drop.
Yeah, Weaver, I think, could be the ace. He could be the opening day pitcher for Arizona.
Very good. Well, they non-tendered Shelby Miller, so yeah.
So, okay, so now, like, so the next pitcher that we're going to talk about is, he's, I guess, the second most notable starting pitching signing. And who would have known that a year ago, that Nathan Eovaldi would get 4 years and $67.5 million from the Boston Red Sox. So Eovaldi was maddeningly inconsistent for pretty much his entire big league career up until this past season. He was very mediocre with the Yankees, but this season he pitched well with the Rays, and he pitched even better following his trade to the Red Sox down the stretch in the regular season and especially during the postseason. So, and the main difference with him was the addition of the cutter to his pitch mix. So there's a lot to like about him. The addition of the cutter, you have the walking very few batters. His control has always been top notch. But, you know, durability is the main issue. How many innings can we expect from Eovaldi on a year-to-year basis? You know, can we expect him to make 25 starts every year? I'm not so sure. So from a fantasy owner, those are the kind of things you're looking at and you're valuing. Are you scared of Eovaldi from a mixed league standpoint this year?
I'm not scared, but he's probably someone people are going to chase because of the potential, and they're going to go after us. They're going to think he signed a big contract. He's going to throw 100 innings because of the big contract. I feel like the Red Sox are going to treat him more like the Dodgers treat almost all of their pitchers, and they're going to look at Eovaldi as someone who he'll go 130, he'll go 140. They'll rest him. They'll be careful. 150 innings feels like the ceiling to me. And the other piece with Eovaldi, you know, as good as he was last year, you know, you look at his numbers, he had a 3.81 ERA. He had a 3.6 FIP. And, you know, his DRA was lower. He had a 3.23. And, you know, obviously that's our component stat. But he's not somebody that I'm going to count on him doing that again. So I see him as more of a 3 or even a 4. And I feel like enough people are going to push him because of that big contract and because of the Red Sox, because of the big postseason, that he'll be ranked higher by others than he will be by me.
Yeah, I'm a little concerned about him. I was actually hoping that the Yankees wouldn't sign him because there was a lot of talk that they would sign him. So from a Yankee fan standpoint, I'm like, you know what? He already failed with the Yankees. Why are we signing him again?
Well, who are the Yankees going to get though? Like I'm sorry.
Now it's kind of like a game of musical chairs where there's really no one left. It's true, but
It sounds like Jay Happ is the guy they might wind up.
Yeah,
with.
Probably wind up with Happ.
And I like Jay Happ. He's just, you know, he's a little older though, and he's not really. He's good. He's not an elite pitcher.
But you could sign him for 3 years. That's the one major difference. So
right. Well, and Charlie Morton's the other guy like that. Morton's getting talked about as a 2 or 3 year pitcher. Right. I don't see him with the Yankees. That doesn't feel like a fit to me. But yeah, that's what Morton looks like as well.
And the Yankees also like those guys who, you know, already proved that they could handle New York and pitch well with the Yankees, and then they sign him to an extension. That's Yankee style. So I could definitely see. I'd be surprised if Happ doesn't come back. And then there's also the possibility for the Yankees for, you know, to make a trade, maybe for Kluber or maybe for Bauer. So we'll see about that. But all right, now Eovaldi. So I think we pretty much covered Eovaldi. You know, he's not someone I'm going to be targeting pretty much at all for fantasy, just because I'm worried about his ability to stay healthy and accrue those counting stats. All right. So now we'll go back to Washington. We were with Washington earlier with Corbin. Now we're going to go back to the Nationals, who acquired Yan Gomes from the Indians. Now, although Gomes's raw stats don't exactly, you know, jump off the page, considering the, you know, dearth of talent at the catching position, he's been one of the most consistent offensive performers at the position over the past few years. So he finished last year ranked 7th on the ESPN player rater. So I think, you know, he's definitely a top 10 catcher. The biggest concern for me is the playing time, because now the Nationals signed Kurt Suzuki earlier in the offseason. So how are they going to handle that? Is that going to be a, you know, 70% Gomes, 30% Suzuki, or is it going to be a 50-50 split? I mean, there's a big difference depending on what that playing time distribution is going to be.
Yeah, although as I, you know, I did the transaction analysis on this, and I wrote up both Gomes and Suzuki as part of that move. It's overstated a little bit, because if you look at Suzuki and Tyler Flowers in Atlanta, and then you look at Gomes and Suzuki combined, they lose about 150 plate appearances total. So it's a drop, and you want to discount both of them a couple rounds, but you don't want to go too far. But to your point, Zach, you are right. If Gomes is the guy who gets 65, 70% of the plate appearances and Suzuki gets 30 to 35, that's the piece that's difficult to predict, and where this is a little erratic. Funny thing about Gomes, though, is he's really – this works out for him health-wise because outside of 2014, he's always missed a little bit of time. So if you look at Gomes and you're expecting 15 home runs, a 250 batting average, averaging out the last couple of years with him in about 400 plate appearances, I think that could work. I feel like Suzuki's going to get hurt a little bit more. And the final point I make is because it's catcher – it doesn't hurt them as much as it would another position if you had a platoon. You know, outside of like someone like Salvador Perez or Gary Sanchez if he's healthy, Buster Posey if he's healthy, Wilson Contreras, there aren't too many catchers who are going to get 500 plate appearances. It's something that's not happening as much that did a few years ago.
Yeah, that's a good point. You're always going to be behind and get. I know in one of my my daily transaction leagues, you know, catcher is we have a maximum games played, and a maximum games played for catcher is, you know, what, 2 times 162, and that's always the position that people are like minus 50, and you know, by the end of the season. So yeah, catcher, you're going to be lucky if you fill 90% of your catcher game. That's almost impossible. And
it's funny. I'm in an odd new league where it's just 162. Like you have two catcher slots, but that's the limit. Like it's essentially a one catcher leave and they have two catcher slots. And because I had Gary Sanchez last year, I wound up like with crummy catchers, like trying to fill up the 162. It was really annoying.
Yeah. I haven't mastered the art of this in this league. I think that the guys who win this league all the time are people who they have like four catchers on their team and they're able to reserve like two catchers every day for the whole season. I just can't do that. I can't devote roster spots to catchers.
I'm the same way you are. I'm challenged by leagues with like games requirements, but for that reason, because I'm used to Roto where you can pretty much just bombard, whether it's innings or at bats, especially you can just bombard and just try to win by volume.
And I'm actually the commissioner of the league, so I'm the one who makes the rules, and I can't even find a way to win with those rules. So
you have to change the rules.
Yeah, I might have to take your advice with that one. You know, the 162 game limit for the two catchers. That sounds like a pretty decent idea. I'll have to bring that up to my put that one for vote in February. So Gomes, you know, I tend to choose someone in that kind of back end of the top 10 range for catcher, you know, to be my number one catcher. So Gomes will definitely be on my radar. But the playing time thing, I think that's the main issue with him. That's what I'm going to keep an eye on. But yeah, I can see myself owning Gomes this season.
Yeah, I could too. Like last year, I know in the labor team we had, I got Cervelli cheap. I guess strong on Flowers as opposed to Suzuki, but I don't mind taking a catcher at a job share if the catcher's cheap enough.
Yeah, if you're the type that waits on the, you know, waits as long as you can to get that number one catcher, you'll end up with Gomes as your number one catcher. I don't think it's something that you should be really disappointed about. Let's put it that way. So the next move we're gonna talk about, this happened, I guess, a couple of days ago. And this is something that I was actually surprised that the Brewers non-tender Jonathan Scope. I mean, I guess it shouldn't be much of a surprise just because they're roster situation with all the infielders, but you know, this is a pretty good player to be available just on the free agent wire, you know, just basically for money, for nothing else. And you know, it's hard to believe just a year ago, you know, Scope was a top five, top six, top seven fantasy second baseman. He had 32 homers in 2017. So you know, he's going to look to bounce back with the Twins. Signs a one-year deal, and that's always going to be – he's going to be under the – he's going to have all the motivation he needs to have that bounce-back season. I'm a little concerned about the home ballpark. You know, he goes from Baltimore for most of the year last year to Minnesota. But I do think that, you know, the playing time, just being able, knowing that you're going to be the everyday second baseman, playing every day, as opposed to a situation in Milwaukee where he basically didn't play for pretty much the entire month of September. So that must have been tough. I think getting back into the, you know, swing of things with the at-bats, knowing you're not going to be yanked from the lineup, I think that'll make a difference for him. So do you expect him to bounce back, or what level of a bounce back do you expect from Scope?
I expect a bounce back to maybe 2016 as opposed to 2017. That was a career year. The average really spiked. He had over 30 home runs. I'd look at more 20 to 25 home runs with a 250, 260 average. What concerns me about Scope, what always has, is he has absolutely no plate discipline. He swings at just about everything. And players like that are really tough because if it works out like it has for Scope the last few years before 2018, you can get a 260, 270 batting average with the power. I just don't trust that. And if he hits 240 with 20 home runs, even at second base or even especially at second base, that isn't as special as it would have been a few years ago.
It really depends on the context, you know, of your team, I think. You know, I owned Scope during his career year in Tout and foolishly traded him in midseason. I tried to sell high on him, and his value ended up even going up after I traded him. But I owned him for about half the season in 2017, and then I drafted him this past year, not necessarily someone I was targeting, but in the team context of my team, I kind of needed that high, 25 to 30 home run second baseman. I was a little bit short in power. So I think with him, it really depends on the rest of your roster up to that point in the draft. But I do think that, 270, 25, 80 type of line with Minnesota. I think that's definitely well within reach. You know, I could see that. I could see 270, 25, 80. Like you said, more 2016 than 2017.
He's someone too. You have to kind of ignore the warp and just look at him for fantasy. If you look at his real life value, that's when you get stuck thinking, well, he's great in 2017. Otherwise, he's a one or two win player. It doesn't matter if the Twins roll him out there for 150 games. He'll get his home runs.
Right, and the big difference this year, like we mentioned with Bruce even, is his value, his price is going to be very cheap. You're going to be able to get him as a middle infielder, even in a deep mix league probably. So maybe he'll be a back end of the top 15 second baseman. So, it's another situation where a guy who was maybe a little overrated last year, he might be a little bit underrated this year. So, Scope's going to be a guy that I'm going to be definitely considering at that stage of drafts.
Yeah, I agree. He's somebody... Yeah, I'm looking at him right now, just outside the top 200. Definitely a bargain compared to where he's been. I actually think that price is appropriate. I don't see it as necessarily a bargain, but I think it's okay.
Yeah, I wouldn't have a problem, investing in him. But it all depends on the price, and it all depends on what your roster looks like at that point in the draft. So let's now move on to another catcher signing. We talked about Yan Gomes. Now we're going to go to Houston, where the Astros signed Robinson Chirinos to a one-year contract. And, I like the signing for the Astros. The average is not going to be great from Chirinos, but he did hit a combined 35 homers over the last two seasons. So, and now he'll be hitting in a very strong Astros lineup. So you got to like that. From a fantasy perspective, how would you rate him? I'd say he's a low end number one, high end number two catcher in deeper mixed leagues. And would you agree with that?
Yeah, that's about right. He's probably a little lower than that for me, just because the batting average outside of 2017, you're always going to take a hit there. My other thing about Chirinos, it sounds like the Astros might try to bring in somebody else or played Max Stassi a little bit more than he did last year. So you're going to lose some games with Chirinos. That'll help his average, but it'll hurt him a little bit with runs and runs batted in. So he's okay. It's catcher. You have to kind of take all this with a grain of salt. It's not a good position. I see him in a two-catcher league. He's a solid second catcher.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I think also he's considered a pretty good defender, so that's gonna bode well for him in terms of playing time. He might not play, 80% of the time, but he'll play, two-thirds of the time at least. So
I'd have to look at it, but I know his framing numbers, according to us, fell off. Well, I shouldn't say his framing numbers. His fielding numbers fell off, according to us, last year. They really dropped. I do wonder if some of that was because he had more plate appearances than he's had in his career, and if he does get into a split, if that'll help a little bit. The only thing about Chirinos is he'll be 35 years old in June, and because he hasn't been a regular, I don't see him falling off the cliff. But it is something to keep in mind. It is, you know, a reason why I don't see him playing more than like 100 games. And if he has, it probably means the Astros have a problem or had an injury.
All right. Well, you might have now just talked me out of drafting Chirinos. So I'll have to think about this again.
We have to look at catchers because honestly, it's a rough position.
I have to look at the list. I don't have an idea in my head of like, oh, who's the top, you know, who's the top 20 guy, who's the top 15 guy.
Right.
But yeah, he's someone who you know, he's, I think, you know, if you could have him as you're in a mixed league, if he's your second catcher, you're in pretty good shape.
Yeah. So I agree with that.
Yeah, I that's how I view Chirinos at this point. But okay, so now we've actually come to our last player that we're going to discuss, and this is a very minor player, I think, and it's Chris Owings, who signs a 1-year deal with the Royals. Now, Owings has so far fallen well short of expectations as a big leaguer. He came into the big leagues, and you know, fantasy owners were expecting him to be a reliable power speed guy with Arizona, and he was dealt with some injuries, inconsistency. Do you like this signing by the Royals, and are you interested in Owings from a fantasy standpoint?
I like Owings as a back end spec player. I don't think much of him as a real life player. What's interesting to me about the Royals, so the Royals have Whit Merrifield, they have Alberto Mondesi, they just signed Owings. They're talking about Billy Hamilton. The Royals are a team that could very much be like, F it. We're just going to try to steal. We know we're not going to win. We're just going to try to steal as many bases as possible. Where Owings intrigues me is in his career as a major leaguer, 83 attempts and 70 steals. He's had good years. He's had bad years. Regardless of what he's done with the bat, which hasn't been much, he has an 81 career DRC. We know he can run. So if he can keep that average up at about 240, 250, which he's done in some years in his career, he could steal as a full-timer 30 bases. That's where I'm interested in Owings. I don't think much of him as a player in real life. I'm intrigued if this is the year the Royals are like, you know what, let's make it interesting for our fans and let's constantly try to be stealing on the other team.
That is very interesting. And the other interesting thing about Owings is, you know, he could play many different positions, so playing time is not going to be an issue for him at all. He's going to be in there as long as he's healthy. He's going to be in there every day. So, like you said, you know, 30 stolen base possibility. I was going to say that he's definitely AL only league material, but you know what? If he does that, he's going to be a mainstay in mixed league rosters.
He's a guy in deep mix that would probably try to like spec on in reserve and see what happens. You know, if he doesn't work out, if he doesn't play, you know, so what? You throw him away. If he gets enough playing time, he gets 450 plate appearances and can get those 25 to 30 steals, that's a nice last player to have, or a nice player to have that you can kind of throw in a week that somebody's hurt or a week that your worst hitter has bad matchups, like a lefty facing a bunch of lefties. Yeah, the thing about Owings is a disappointment. He's a disappointment as I think people are looking at him as a power speed guy.
Right.
The power has not really been there, and it never will be. He can run. Like that's the thing about Chris Owings. We know he's fast.
And I mentioned in the past, you know, I don't like to draft those one category speed guys, but in the case of Owings, like you said, you know, the price for him is going to be totally right. Minuscule. So that's right.
There's a big difference between drafting Billy Hamilton and you know, Brett, if you're listening to this, I'm sorry. I know you love Billy Hamilton, but there's been drafting Billy Hamilton in the fifth or sixth round of a 15 team mixed versus taking an Owings in the 24th round of a league like that, where if he works, great. If he doesn't, who cares? Like there's 1 year, the year Brett and I won labor, we drafted Anthony Goes, and you know, Anthony Goes didn't work out, but we trade him for like a low level closer, and that was fun.
And Anthony Ghost, who did we pick up? Oh, we picked up Terrence Gore in labor. I get them confused sometimes. Ghost and Gore, but yeah.
Well, didn't Ghost like try to pitch at some point?
Yeah, he pitched. What team was he on? Was he on the Blue Jays when he pitched?
Maybe the Tigers.
I'm not sure which team it was. But
no,
yeah.
He was with the Tigers initially. The Blue Jays were the team that kind of did the experiment with Ghosts.
Yeah, I remember he was a hot fantasy commodity for about like a month or so at that point. But
we traded him for Luke Gregerson when he was a closer with the Astros. So Things move quickly in baseball.
So that actually, that probably turned out to be a good trade because Gregerson had a few good years.
Yeah.
All right. So anything else about Owings or anything else about any other players we talked about? Any predictions for free agent signings, trades?
Oh, gosh. The Phillies are going to get one of Harper, Machado. They're going to spend. They're going to be aggressive. I'd be really shocked if they got shut out. The dark horse to me are the White Sox. They have a lot of money. They have a lot of prospects that are up and coming. It wouldn't surprise me if they overbid on Harper in particular and just were like, you know what? We're not going to win this year, but at some point in the next 8 to 10 years, they're going to win. It's a big market, even though they don't play like one. But what I wonder, Zach, is what do you see the Yankees doing? Because you're up there. You're a Yankees fan. Are they going to sign somebody, or are they going to go smaller player?
Well, I think, you know, Hap is pretty much, I think that's who their top target is for pitching right now. A little surprised they didn't get Corbin, but I can't blame them. I mean, the old Yankees would have gave Corbin 6 years, but I totally don't blame them for stopping at 5 years. So I think Hap, you know, somewhere in the 3 year, maybe, you know, $45 million, $48 million neighborhood for him. So I think they'll probably get Hap. But I also think they should really consider looking at the trade market. What about, you know, Kluber? I don't know. Corey Kluber is getting a little bit old, but at the same time, he has a very team-friendly contract. I know everyone says, oh, why do you care about the contract? You're not the one paying the salary. But I do think that, you know, he's someone to think about. And then I don't know. Who knows about, you know, Trevor Bauer? Is he someone who the Indians are going to really trade? Or I don't. There's a lot of chatter about him as well.
Yeah. Cleveland's weird because they extended Carrasco and they're talking now about trading Kluber and or Bauer. I saw Edwin Encarnacion rumors today. It's weird for a team that is still in the success cycle, particularly with how that division shakes out. But they're probably looking back at the Detroit Tigers of a few years ago where people were like, you know, oh, they don't need to retool. They don't need to rebuild. The 2012 Phillies were another example of a team like that, where Cleveland's looking at it like it's better to do this a year early or do some of it a year early than a year late. And Kluber's somebody who, if he's the pitcher they move in particular, don't forget, he's under contract this year, but there's two team options on him.
Right.
There's a $13.5 million team option for 2020. And a $14 million for 2021, there's escalators. I won't get into that. It's complicated. But even with those escalators, if Kluber is a top-shelf pitcher, he's cheap. He's a really great option for somebody. So I don't like the whole tanking culture, but if you're going to be part of it, it's wise to do within that culture what Cleveland's doing, which is at least explore these possibilities.
Yeah, I would go after Kluber if I was the Yankees. I know he hasn't really had a great postseason resume, so there's questions about that. He's had some injury concerns over the past couple of years. But yeah, like you said, the contract is very appealing. And, you know, with the salary that these pitchers are making now, you know, Corbin, all these free agent pitchers, you know, paying a ace pitcher $15 million a year for, you know, the next 2 or 3 years is a very considerable bargain. So I would.
Yeah,
Kluber's
Kluber's been great. I mean, you know, he's, you look at his numbers since 2014 and he's been terrific.
Yeah. So I would be very happy with Kluber. I'm not sure if they're going to want it. The Yankees are going to want to trade any more of their prospects, but we'll find out about that. But I think, yeah, Hap is a pretty good bet that he comes back. And you know what? I think in the end, I wouldn't be shocked if Machado is a Yankee by this time, about a month from now. But I think I would say, if I had to guess, I would say Machado Yankees, and I'd say Harper Phillies at this point.
Yeah, it makes sense. And the Dodgers are a team that I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't do much, just because, again, you know, they re-upped Kershaw. Teams are treating the luxury tax like a hard cap, and it puts a team like the Dodgers where they're not pushing hard. And the Cubs are the same way. I thought the Cubs would be in on Harper. They don't seem to be tied to him. Now, we know in 2 or 3 weeks the rumor mill can change. You know, there can be someone coming out of the blue. But right now, it looks like the Cubs aren't going to make a big signing, which is really weird given where they are. This is sort of the other side of all this. You know, we can talk about teams like not being ready to win and not spending money. But it's odd that teams that are in a position to win at a time where baseball is more profitable than it's ever been by far don't want to go over that luxury tax. Like they don't want to impact those profits.
Yeah, it is strange. And even the Yankees last year wanting to get under the luxury tax just for that 1 year to reset the penalty.
I miss Steinbrenner. George Steinbrenner. Not as a person, but I miss George Steinbrenner just kind of being like, you know what? I'm going to spend. Other owners didn't like it, you know, particularly the 90s coming out of the strike. He was the one owner that was like, I don't care what it takes. I'm going to spend it. I always think back to what he said. You know, he's from Cleveland and he said something along the lines, I'm paraphrasing, like when they talked about revenue sharing, he's like, if I wanted to buy the Cleveland team, that's a team I would have bought. You know, I could have done that, but I bought into the New York market. That's the puzzling thing about these teams like the Cubs and the Yankees and the Dodgers. I can even get resetting the tax like the Yankees did the 1 year, but now they don't want to go over it after they've done that. The penalty on that first year is low. It's very strange.
I think they'll go over it. I think they just really wanted to get under for that 1 year. And
we know why. But, you know, owners are hoarding money and they're more interested in profit right now than anything else. Or they figured out that they can profit and win. But it's not good for baseball. It's not healthy when you have so many teams not trying at all. It really impacts the game on the field.
Yeah, I wonder, maybe eventually they're going to institute some kind of a salary minimum, salary floor.
It'll be a floor.
That might be interesting. Yeah, I wouldn't be opposed to that at all.
The next CBA is, you know, well, Tony Clark's going to be in charge of it again, but the next CBA in a cut like 2 or 3 years, whenever that is going to be interesting.
Yeah, I'll keep an eye. I would not be surprised if there's some kind of talk about a floor, and I wouldn't be opposed to it at all. So that I think will do it for this edition of Flags Fly Forever. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. I think we'll do one more podcast before the new year?
We're going to do one more before the new year, another one like this where we talk about signings. And then in January, we're going to launch our weekly coverage, starting with Catcher Week in early January.
Yeah, so there should be some more signings to talk about. I'm in a couple of weeks. The winter meetings, I believe, get underway Sunday night and last till through Thursday with the Rule 5 draft. So there'll be definitely a number of more signings to talk about and trades. Probably not as much as we talked about just now, just because that was a really busy period. But there'll be more to discuss. And then after the new year, we'll start with our preview series coverage. So we will be back in a couple of weeks. And until then, keep tracking that hot stove, and we'll see you soon.
Thanks again for listening to Flags Fly Forever, a baseball perspectives podcast. This is episode 178 with Mike Cianella, Jed Makramos behind the glass, and Zach Steinhorn, my co-host. We're really looking forward to coverage in 2019, but we have to get through 2018. We have one more episode like this. This will be our post-winter meetings episode. Hopefully there'll be some really big signings. We're going to talk about Harper and Machado. And it won't be like last winter where teams were holding on and holding on and holding on. But regardless of what's decided, we will have another podcast for you and in about 2 weeks. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.